Good morning, this is Joel Hodson.
Joan Rafe.
Bill Corbett.
Baron Vaughn.
Grace Blue.
Bridget Nelson.
Hampton Young.
Mary Jo Peel.
Rebecca Hansen from Mystery Science Theater 3000. And you are listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Scrolling for July 28th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And we're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find new information. You probably know this, Chip, but I have subscribed to a television service this week.
Well, Steve, COVID has caused many people to do things that they normally wouldn't do.
Yeah. My son, the sports fan, really wanted to watch the Chicago Cubs this week, and it was not available other than giving money to a cable company. So I have subscribed to television service for the first time in I don't even know how long.
Well, you subscribe to a streaming television service. So the service you went with was
Hulu Live, which is $62 a month for all of those cable channels that you would associate with a typical cable system. Mm-hmm. And it includes the new Marquee Network, which is the Chicago Cubs' own private network for Chicago Cubs games, only in the Chicagoland area.
Well, the Cubs are following the Wirtz tradition before the owner passed away, and actually the Blackhawks started playing at regular television schedule. Mm-hmm. We'll see how this plays out for the Cubs. I think the Cubs were very important because they were part of a superstation for many years, and that broadcast in a lot of markets. We'll see if they go exclusive, whether this is going to work to their detriment.
I suspect that it will, because I think you're right. The fact that everybody knew the Cubs was everybody's team because of the availability. You pull that availability, you make it hard for anybody to watch your stuff. Mm-hmm. People are not going to watch your stuff.
Well, this could be a difference between the Tribune owning the company and having a private party doing it. And what I found from my growing up experience being in the South, the Atlanta Braves were very similar to the Cubs because they had their superstation, which was owned by Ted Turner before he sold out to either Viacom or CBS, whichever one you want to call it now.
Mm-hmm.
But Turner was able to take a lovable losing club like the Braves and making them into championship caliber for many, many years. Before he sold out.
Yeah.
So who knows how this ultimately will play out. I've subscribed to YouTube TV for, I guess, the entire COVID time. Normally in the summer, I would not have my streaming cable service as or alternative. So, you know, let's hope COVID goes away so we don't have to, we can find other ways to watch. Yeah.
So I could find other ways to spend that $60? Yeah.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. I got good news, Chip. I finally got to see the new Scooby-Doo movie, which is simply called Scoob!
Scoob! Zoinks!
Zoinks! This movie came out right at the beginning of the COVID and the stay-at-home order, and it was a $20 rental at the time, and I said, I'm not willing to gamble on the $20 rental of this new film. I'll wait. And I waited long enough for HBO Max to pick this up. HBO Max is the new part of HBO that mm-hmm. is featuring a lot of the Warner Brothers material. And Scooby-Doo being a huge part of that Warner Brothers portfolio, they got this new movie. And I got to tell you, Chip, I loved this movie as much as I thought I was going to.
Oh, how lovely. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it is a modernization of that 1960s and 70s Scooby-Doo that we're all very, very familiar with. There's a real shorthand when we talk about Sherlock Holmes and we say this is a Scooby-Doo moment. We all know what we're talking about. A relatively simple mystery that has a very specific plot. All Scooby-Doo episodes are exactly the same, and it's a comfort to know what's going to happen.
Lots of misunderstandings, Steve.
Lots of misunderstandings, and that unmasking at the end where we find out who the real supernatural being was, and it wasn't a supernatural being, it was Old Man Carruthers who was just trying to keep the funhouse, or fill in the blank with whatever old man that it was.
Any messages we should know?
There's some really strong messages about teamwork, friendship, and devotion. The idea of making a promise and sticking with it is a huge theme to this. There's some great messaging about girls can be smart. It's okay. Even Daphne, who stereotypically in the 60s and 70s was the dumb girl, even she has a really relevant part to this story. Boys can be emotional. Freddy has a very emotional part to this. I don't want to spoil anything. I don't want to spoil this cartoon for you, Chip. I know you're never going to watch it, but I know some of our listeners will. The bad guys can have backstories too, but thankfully this does not go into the prequel fashion to say that this bad guy was somehow justified in his actions. We've seen that a lot with the gray spot between good and evil. This does not do that. This is a bad guy who is doing bad things and is punished, but he does have a backstory. He is an interesting character.
And since it's a modern take, does it have references to CBD oil?
Shockingly, no. You might expect, you know what? You know what? You might expect that the psychedelic 1960s being the basis for Scooby-Doo and the idea of Scooby-Dooby-Doo, that is not explored here. But they do all have cell phones. Cell phones become a big part of the plot. That is very 2020. And they do a beautiful reboot of the original 1969 Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Opening sequence. That song in that opening cartoon that we have seen a million times, they did a computer-generated version of that, and I had tears in my eyes, Chip. It was beautiful how they took those images and made them relevant to today.
All right, Steve. You got to see Scooby-Doo. Did you get to see any other movies maybe from the past?
So much. I had a whole week of going to Comic-Con this week, and yes, I couldn't go to San Diego. I've never been to San Diego Comic-Con. And this week, because nobody was able to go to San Diego for Comic-Con, Comic-Con came to us through the internet. It's all kicked off with the Mads from MST3K. They presented a riff of Glenn or Glenda, the 1953 Ed Wood film about transvestites and acceptance of you can wear whatever clothes you want. This was a fantastic riff. It was laugh out loud and really heartfelt. Trace and Frank, two of the mad scientists from MST3K.
Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yes, thank you for explaining to the audience who've listened to the show before and have I ever mentioned Mystery Science? Yeah, I think I have. They had a question and answer after the movie, and boy, they had a lot to say about this movie. Trace really enjoys this film. He called it a bombastic worldview with a great message, and he's absolutely right. I've never seen Glenn or Glenda before, but Ed Wood really had something to say here, and it was very heartfelt because it was semi-autobiographical. And he, And
for those who don't know who Ed Wood is a director who's known for making the best worst movies ever.
He is, yes, he is one of those names that he made bad movies, but they were so good because they were so genuine. He put himself into this art so much that it's hard to make fun of what he did. Even when you look at it, you go, "That yeah, he could have done that better."
Oh, yes, it is. It's pretty easy to make fun of his work. And Johnny Depp and spent a movie doing that.
Yes, the Ed Wood movie is certainly where I started my knowledge of Ed Wood, where Johnny Depp portrayed this man in a kind way, not at all making fun of him, but at the same time going, yeah, he was quite a character in his time.
So did Frank have some words to say about this?
Yes, he did. He said that this movie was ahead of its time in terms of its compassion. And I really saw that in their riff here. The compassion that is expressed for people who feel like they are weird, the weirdos of the world, whatever it is that makes them unusual. There's a deep, true compassion here that the message is we are all weird in our own way. We should be allowing other people to be weird in their way.
So is the purpose of this movie just to show that a person can dress up, a male can dress up as a female?
Yeah, that is really the message of Glenn or Glenda. That is really an hour and a half of this is weird and weird is okay. Time has changed our view of sex and sexuality a lot from 1953. We're a lot more sympathetic. And in the writing of the 1990s was still thoughtful and sympathetic, but there's some pretty cringy jokes that are still told in the 1990s in the Mystery Science Theater era. And they talked about that in the Q&A. Frank said, "I'm the only person in history to move from New York to the Midwest and get a job on TV." That was a lot of fun to hear Frank talk about his journey to where he is. They are doing this again on August 18th. They're going to riff The Tingler, the famous Vincent Price movie from 1959, and tickets are available at themadsareback.com. I look forward to that one.
Looks like you got to watch a little Riff Tracks this week, too.
Yeah, sort of, a little bit. Riff Tracks presented Stranger Things Episode 1, but they did that live, and the technology completely failed them. They were trying out a different app instead of just using Zoom like Trace and Frank did. They were trying out a different app, and it failed miserably. Those of us who spent our evening watching it, were entertained by the comedy of errors in this. I look forward to them fixing that system and making a better system for riffing live.
And we don't know why that failed for them, but it could be that a company paid for the rights to Riff Tracks to test it out, and obviously it didn't work as planned. That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Steve, you were San Diego Comic-Con is there. Anything you watched of interest?
I watched so many panels. I went to more panels this way than I would have gone to if I was actually in San Diego. The Bugs Bunny 80th anniversary panel was wonderful. Billy West, the voice, one of the many voices of Bugs Bunny and so many other voices, along with Leonard Maltin, one of the historians of Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes, along with a whole other cast of people whose names I don't know, talked about Bugs Bunny and the deep history that we have with that character.
Steve, were you able to go where no person has gone before?
There were so many Star Trek panels this year at San Diego Comic-Con. Lower Decks, the new animated series, was premiered.
Steve, were they celebrating the 50th anniversary?
No, no, they still haven't celebrated the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and I don't think they ever will. Boy, boy, oh boy, did they drop the ball on that one. But there's so much innovation that's coming to Star Trek as a result of CBS All Access. We're getting this new animated series, Lower Decks, and we got to meet the cast of that one. Jerry O'Connell plays the first mate on that ship. His wife, Rebecca Romijn, plays a first mate on a different Star Trek series, and the two of them love hanging out with Jonathan Frakes. So Jerry O'Connell said that he should film their meetings, the three of them, because that's three first mates all hanging out together, and a good time is had by all.
It's time for our listeners to grab some tea, maybe Earl Grey and hot.
Earl Grey, hot. The Picard panel was so much fun. Sir Patrick Stewart, being the center of that, was there. Marina Sirtis, Allison Pill, Michelle Hurd, Brett Spiner, Jonathan Frakes, Jerry Ryan, all came together to talk about the first season and to debate the eternal question whether or not they should call him SPS, Sir Patrick Stewart. They called him SPS, and he went, "I don't know who that is." And they went, "That's you." He went, "Oh, okay." It was a very loving panel. There was an MST3K panel with some of the old members of that troupe, Joel Hodgson, Bill Corbett, and J. Elvis Weinstein, who came together. They raised $20,000 for a charity in Minneapolis, and they are going to come together, the three of them, and riff two shorts. They've never worked together. J. Elvis left before Bill Corbett came on, and I look forward to the three of them taking up those roles in MST3K.
Well, does Dr. Johnny Fever and Venus Flytrap, do they have a connection to one of the robots?
Uh-huh. Josh said his Tom Servo voice, the original Tom Servo voice, came from WKRP in Cincinnati. It was his rendition of that FM radio DJ. That's where Tom Servo's voice comes from. It was kind of fun to think of that. I had never seen him give an interview about his motivation for the original Tom Servo. And Bill being the second Crow, Joel said to Bill, it was like Crow had had a stroke when Crow became a new person. And the opening of the sci-fi series, Crow said, "I'm different." And he put it right out there. He is a different actor, not Trace being the voice of Crow. This was a great conversation. I look forward to the three of them having more conversations.
All right. So, Steve, there's a grown man maybe wearing a hockey jersey and his cap on backwards. Who is that?
That is that Kevin Smith. Not our Kevin Smith, that Kevin Smith. And he is a big part of the Internet Movie Database, and he is a big part of interviewing people at Comic-Con. He got a chance to host the panel for Bill and Ted Face the Music, the new Bill and Ted movie that's coming soon.
The original TED Talk.
I love that meme. I don't remember seeing the original TED Talk, but I heard it was excellent. This was a great panel. Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves, Bill S. Preston Esquire, and Ted Theodore Logan were there, along
the Wild Stallions.
That's right. Along with the director, Dean Parasote, who you know as the director of Galaxy Quest. He is the director of the new movie.
I hope this is good.
I have high expectations for this. The original writers, Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson, were there, and they told the story. I had never heard this story before. Those two men played these two characters in college, and then somebody convinced them to write a screenplay. They walked around college being Bill and Ted, and then they wrote the screenplay, and then they saw Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves at a fast food place before the two of them were cast in the roles.
So Keanu and Alex are friends.
Yes, they are really, truly, really good friends. And they told the story in the panel about the audition process. There were dozens of people auditioning for these two roles, and the two friends got the parts because of their deep friendship that was before they got the roles of Bill and Ted. How about that?
Well, they had lots of trivia. Born on President's Day. Dollar bill guy.
The new movie features the next generation of Bills and Teds, Samara Weaving and Bridget Lundy Payne play Bill's daughter and Ted's daughter. Bill's daughter's name is Thea Preston, and Ted's daughter's name is Billy Logan.
Oh my.
But I still have high expectations. Besides, yes, I could see how you say oh my to that, but I still have high expectations. Samara Weaving is Hugo Weaving's niece. Hugo Weaving played Agent Smith in The Matrix. Okay. How about that?
That is interesting.
This panel was fantastic. Kevin Smith said that he thought this movie was a winner. Now, can we judge Kevin Smith?
No, we cannot.
Okay.
Okay, but maybe George Carlin's Force Ghost can come back and potentially help us out.
Spoilers. Spoilers, my friend. There was a George Carlin spoiler in this panel. I will not share it, but it was in the panel. You can go to the YouTube and watch that.
Steve, with COVID out there, it's always good to find a doctor.
Mm-hmm. There is a huge multimedia event coming soon, and it is told across the entire Doctor Who universe. This is Doctor Who Time Lord Victorious. It's being overseen by a friend of the show, James Goss, who is a wonderful author, and he is putting together this multimedia event across 10 different platforms and 35 different products to tell the story of Time Lord Victorious.
All right, so did you watch this?
This was just the panel explaining what they were working on.
Oh, okay.
This is going to take years to watch. There's Big Finish audio dramas. There are Titan comics. There are novels. They have an escape room planned for this. There's an immersive theater experience and a line of toys coming from this Doctor Who story. This is an amazing feat for them to take one story and to spread it across so many different products and platforms.
Well, 50% of the Too Much Scrolling cast can't get enough of this.
There's a lot of people, Chip, who are going to spend a lot of money on Time Lord Victorious, and one of us is one of them, sir. As much fun as we had talking to James Goss about his experience in Doctor Who over the last three decades, I look forward to what he's able to put together. He is super excited about what he has put together thus far. Being able to be something other than just an author, putting together this massive multimedia event. I'm pretty stoked for this. Oh boy. You watched the Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga. Tell us all about that.
Well, it looks like the Funny or Die cast of Will Ferrell and Andy McKay have spent a lot of time. I shouldn't call him that. There was the Gary Sanchez Productions. They've spent a lot of time studying Adam Sandler. And they've decided that if Adam Sandler can make a lot of money by going to Netflix and making films and doing, I don't know, travel budgets, that Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams can do this too. And that's where Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, comes in, Steve.
Oh, boy.
This movie is awful.
Okay, good.
I will go ahead and just tell you, 33 out of 100. One thing you can say about Will Ferrell is he is fearless. He is willing to try all sorts of comedy stuff, calling the Rose Bowl parade, creating this crazy character, Saturday Night Live skits, Funny or Die. he certainly throws a lot out there. Sometimes it hits big, and sometimes it's just pretty flat. This is silly, stupid, fun. If you like Adam Sandler's Netflix work, you'll love this. And let's just say 33 out of 100. It's there for you.
Is there a story to it, or is it just silly scene after silly scene?
Steve, a kid in Iceland watched the Eurovision Song Contest and decided one day that was going to be him. And so Lars and his girlfriend, Sigrid, they somehow got a chance to audition for the Icelandic, I guess, to be the contestant on Eurovision. And while everyone is celebrating on a boat, it blew up and all of them died. And left only Lars and Sigrid. And there they got to be the representative there. So let's just start off with that.
Oh, boy.
If that kind of...
That's a ringing endorsement. In,
you should probably go and see this movie.
No.
No?
No.
It's on Netflix, Steve.
It's on Netflix. You're already paying for Netflix. You might as well watch it. That's your review. Oh, boy. You also got to see My Comic Shop Country. Tell me about that. I don't know this one.
This is actually really interesting. This came out last fall. It is from 2019. I was not aware of it either. What I found really interesting is it does have Mark Hammond. He's the manager at All Your Comics. We met him in Skokie a number of times. He certainly is a wonderful character, certainly very knowledgeable of the comic book industry. And I think that this was a really nice tribute to those people who run comic book stores. And this was all spurred on because there was a store called Alternate Realities in New York. And after 23 years of operation, the owner decided at that point he was going to close it down. He wasn't making enough money to make it work. And one of the employees decided that he was going to interview a number of people who own comic book stores and talk a little bit about the culture that these stores kind of represent and who goes in there and why is it a community and what types of interesting things can we learn from them. And I really enjoyed this because if you've been to a comic book store, there's all different types. There's some that look like they're in the bottom of a basement that looks like it's been flooded, and others that look like they're like the most modern place in the world. And there's room for different types of retail establishment, but the people who go in, they form this community. And much like the local watering hole, they come in and they want to talk about the latest movies. They want to talk about the books they've read. They want to talk about their comics. And just talk about life in general and how these people kind of found themselves. So I found this to be fascinating. I'm going to run through a couple things. A couple of interviews they had with Mark Hammond, who I talked about from All Yeah Comics. And All Yeah is a place where they always have an event going on. So one of the things that I did with them a few months ago before COVID, Art Baltazar, who is a wonderful local writer and artist. He writes truly children's comics. He decided he was going to do a drink and draw. So if as an adult, you can stop by, you bring your pencils, your crayons, your markers, whatever you want to. And then there was probably about 20 or 30 people. Many of them are professionals who work in any number of art industries. And some of them were just guys like me who were just looking for something to do. You can bring your pencil and paper. And so we talked a little bit about techniques. We talked a little bit about what were types of things we want to work on. But really, it's there to go sort of and hang out and enjoy yourself. And I did it because I haven't drawn in a long time, and I got to play. Mark Wade owned a comic shop in Muncie, Indiana. And they renamed it All Yeah. He basically came under the All Yeah umbrella also. For those who do not know Mark Wade, Mark Wade is a writer, and he's written Captain America and Flash, and usually they're memorable runs. He's written The Avengers. And he is also incredibly, has a deep trivia knowledge of comic books. And I found a little, not from this movie, but there's a group of four people who liked to challenge Mark Wade in trivia contests during C2E2 here in Chicago. And a couple of years ago, they came close to defeating Mark Wade. But but Mark Wade is like the ultimate trivia person.
Got it. That's fun. I love trivia.
Mark Wade talks a little bit about the business of comics. Comic book shops are dying, and the model is changing and all sorts of things. It's a shame that small retailers are being taken out. But, you know, life marches on.
But the publishing industry has certainly changed too. You know, mm-hmm. just as much as I had a great community with the video store and people coming to the video store to have those conversations, when the video store culture changed, that community kind of went away. Same thing is happening with comic books at this point.
Well, any type of publishing. You're absolutely right. And I think that you've hit it right there. And Mark Wade's shop, once again, is near Ball State. And I didn't realize this, but the rule of thumb is you order your monthly books or your weekly books. And what your goal is you want to, if you order $1,500 worth of product, you want to have $1,500 worth of sales or more mm-hmm. the day that happens. And then the other 6 days of your store is to basically make your profit, to pay for your employees, to pay for the other stuff. So you recognize they run on, you can just see just from the model, it's very, very tight mm-hmm. Business model. In fact, if you're loose with it, you'll lose your store. And that's what we were learning a little bit about this. I had met this guy, never in person, but his name is Lord Retail, Jermaine Axum. And he's from Acme Comics in Greensboro. And I actually met him online at a board at some point. And he was a very interesting guy. He's grew up in the D.C. area, and his family moved down to Greensboro. And he had gotten, ultimately, what we call Lyme disease now. And he received a comic book, and he's just really good and very knowledgeable. I think that's one of the things that you learn from this movie, is that every store has sort of their character. And this is the person that makes people feel welcome, helps identify maybe reading trends that you like, and then recommend other things. And I think that's exactly where it needs to come from. Running a bookstore is not necessarily about knowing only the hot products. It's about knowing your clientele well enough to be able to make recommendations of stuff. Mm-hmm. I'll stop talking about this. If you have interest in it, it is worthy of your time. And I think that you will find something of interest there. But you know what we really should do, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
We should find out what Stacey saw.
Hi, everyone. This week I watched The Beach House, Jeffrey A. Brown's debut horror feature, which is new to video on demand. The Beach House follows Randall and Emily, who decide to go on a peaceful couple's trip to his parents' holiday home by the sea. When they get there, it turns out his parents' friends are already staying, but that's just the start of the problems they face as a mysterious infection takes hold. I should start out by saying this is definitely a film of two halves. The first is slow and sparse, much like the beach they're situated on. I did have some trouble staying engaged with it to start out with because it really does take its time. But as it goes on, it starts to allude to the strangeness that's happening, and you realise the pace is there to evoke suspense and a feeling of creepiness as little things start to not feel right. And then it got my full attention as, like the characters, I too was trying to figure out what was going on. The quiet, almost mundaneness of the first half lulls you into thinking that this is a sleepy little horror. But the second half shifts gears and your weight truly pays off as the strangeness amps up. There's a heavy mist that gives an unsettling claustrophobic effect, which is somewhat akin to Invasion of the Body Snatchers in creepiness, featuring special effects that also wouldn't look out of place in Hellraiser. It's all still fairly mysterious as the story goes on, but there's some great exposition from the police radio and the emergency broadcast service bulletins that explain what's happening and give it a bit of a Night of the Living Dead vibe, which I really liked. Using such a small cast can be tricky, but all four cast members here play their parts really well. And though they're all very different people, they seem likeable from what we know of them. In the first half of the film, they have some really good dialogue together as they relax and bond as a group, which gives you enough insight into their characters to know that you wouldn't wish anything that happens to them in the second half of the film on them. There's also some nice foreshadowing with Emily's degree choice, which links directly to what's going on, so make sure to pay attention for that, because that's what pricked my ears up and left me with a feeling of what might come. As you can tell, my feelings about The Beach House changed as I watched it. It grew on me. I went to this film completely blind, even avoiding trailers. Having gone back now and seen the trailer, I'd say watch the film without it if possible, because it allows you to enjoy it in a more mysterious detective-like way, much like the characters involved. Doing the detective work myself made the whole thing far more fun, as it put me in the shoes of the characters in the film, and you'll probably find it more suspenseful that way. The Beach House is an eco-horror zombie-esque story that takes its time to build a creepy story that's truly bleak and leaves you wondering right up until the end. If you're looking for a neat or a happy ending, you won't find it here, but if you want something to ponder on, this is a great choice. And they've definitely allowed you to do that with the end credits that just have the sound of the waves crashing on the shore, whilst you reflect on what you've just watched and what might have happened after the film ended. Heavy going and thinky in the same way as some of the best classic horrors and sci-fis were. This is an increasingly engrossing watch as it goes on, and an impressive debut feature. So for anyone who loves a bit of detective work whilst they watch, they'll enjoy this. And that's all for this time, so if you want to hear any more of my ramblings on films, chat with me about horror, or have a film you'd like reviewed, you can find me on Twitter, at Films with Stacey, and Instagram, at The Horror Movie Maven, where you can also find links to my website to read more. Until next time, happy viewing!
Thank you, Stacey. It's wonderful hearing from you. Keep watching those movies that I sometimes watch with you.
Me.
Oh, good. The rest of the show is going to be all in Beaker talk. There's a new Muppet series. We are being reintroduced to the Muppets this week. Muppets Now is premiering on Disney Plus, finally. This has been highly anticipated. I look forward to knowing the Muppets. I don't know anything about the Muppets. Disney, can you explain the Muppets for us?
Well, I'm sure the special effects budget will be right on the level of The Mandalorian.
I hope the writing is just as off-kilter as it ever was in the original series. I love the improv that the puppeteers can do with the Muppets, and I look forward to their next presentation, Muppets Now. There is a...
So we went from Muppets to puppets, Steve.
Okay, so there's a movie that Stacey has already said she's very excited to watch for us. It's called Killer Raccoons 2, Dark Christmas in the Dark.
So it's a Christmas movie being released during COVID-19 in July, August?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there we go. That's the first thing. And then the raccoons are totally realistic. I think they spent extra money on the on those costumes.
I think that they are just stuffed raccoons that don't actually move, but they move them for this movie.
So I'm going to call this the Snowpiercer of raccoon movies, Steve.
Oh, boy. You know that there are actually a lot of people that like Snowpiercer, right?
Well, they like black jello, Steve.
You know that there's a Snowpiercer series that's doing actually pretty well on television right now.
Sure. And I'm going to go ahead and end with this. Looks like I've bitten off more than I can chew. That was at the end of the trailer, Steve.
That was the stinger at the end. That's the kind of humor that you look forward to in Killer Raccoons 2.
Well, Steve, that's not the only documentary. Documentary?
Half drama, half documentary?
And comedy. I don't know what we call this.
And there's a comedy in there somewhere, too. Yeah, this one, I don't know what to call this one. Tijuana Jackson, Purpose Over Prison. This is a comedic look at an ex-convict on parole trying to become a world-renowned motivational speaker. Yeah, this is a comedy. It's supposed to be funny. It is very much like The Office, the fourth wall-breaking documentary series.
Maybe not as good.
I don't know, man. I did not get a great vibe off of the trailer, for sure.
Well, Steve, speaking of not getting a good vibe, is that what you're saying, Steve?
Yes, that's what I was going to say. That was the transition I was going to make to the movie Unhinged, featuring Russell Crowe as a man on a mission here, Chip.
Steve, this is about road rage and about a man who is on a mission. And I have no idea why somebody sat down and said, you know, we probably need a road rage film with Russell Crowe chasing down people and running over cars. That sounds like an awesome premise.
Oh, this trailer. this trailer just looks awful.
It looks like a fake movie, doesn't it?
It looks like a fake movie. I absolutely agree with your prognosis, Doctor. This is really Russell Crowe. Wow. I don't know how this film got made.
And here's the other part about it. It says it's coming out, but we don't really know. And maybe they just release it, because I don't know how this thing is going to do in a real theater if it opens. So, regardless, streaming this week, we have another film, Steve.
This one is called The Shadow of Violence. This is another one of those English, boy, do we have problems with certain people and mob action. This is a father and son, drug-dealing family, former boxers and hitmen, and oh boy.
Lots of violence there, Steve. Mm. Steve, what happens if you received a prediction?
She dies tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry. We should actually explain that joke.
This is the strangest trailer. This says it's a comedy and a thriller.
Yeah, the movie is...
I don't see any comedy here, Steve.
Other than the awkwardness of the thriller, this is a movie called She Dies Tomorrow. That is the title of this film. And it's about a woman who believes that she will die tomorrow. And she tells everyone in her family, in her relationships, that she's going to die tomorrow, and everybody gets all tied up into this thought.
Well, everyone, you know, every movie has to have a premise and a hook, and I'm not sure if this one or Unhinged has figured out what theirs is.
Yeah.
Steve, let's move on to the ACLU.
Good. There is an actual documentary called The Fight that's coming out this week. This is an inside look at the legal battles that the lawyers for the American Civil Liberties Union are facing in 2020. There's a lot of fight in this movie for sure.
If I wasn't going to watch a raccoon film, Steve, this is the film I'd probably want to see.
Really? I would rather watch the raccoons. Book it. Brings us to our book of the week. You know your stuff, Mr. Hessenflow.
Well, I don't always know my stuff. I pretend. There's a lot of pretending going on, Steve.
So in your effort to know more stuff, you have read another Brian Kaplan book today. This one, The Myth of the Rational Voter: Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. Boy, oh boy, that is a deep title, my friend.
Yeah. No, I've read a number of papers by Brian Kaplan, and Brian Kaplan is a wonderful person. He's very charming, certainly interesting, and incredibly thoughtful. He runs, I think it's called Cap Fest at his house, where it's like a weekend of gaming, where between everyone playing games and the karaoke, everyone comes to his house and has a good time. So his students are invited and everything like that. He is a professor at George Mason University in the economics department, and I went to that school. So Open Borders, The Science of Ethics and Immigration by Zach Wienersmith and Brian Kaplan was maybe how many of us got introduced to his work. But I've known him for a while. Now, this is a great book. He probably could use a little Zach Wienersmith drawing for it, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the ideas that he brings out in this book. And once again, he's a provocateur, so his idea is to make sure that there is a hook here and that you leave with maybe a different way of understanding some of the challenges that we have. So the greatest obstacle to sound economic policy is not entrenched in special interest or rampant lobbying, but the popular misconceptions, irrational beliefs, and personal biases held by ordinary voters. And so this is you and me, and this is anybody around you, and they're spewing off like, we should do this and we should do that. Now, the answer to that is not always listed in this book, but there is wisdom in crowds. So even if we have biases and even if we're off, there's wisdom in the group of us making decisions. But Kaplan argues that voters continually elect politicians who either share their biases or pretend to. And so if you've ever wondered why you're not really fitting in with what's going on in Congress or the president or who we nominate for Supreme Court justice or your local politicians or whatever, you're going to figure out that you have biases, and those biases help you make your decisions. And anyway, maybe they'll work to your benefit, maybe they won't. Kaplan contends that democracy fails because the politicians do what the voters want, too. So if you've ever seen somebody grandstanding on television, like, I believe this, and you all should believe this, too, remember, they're speaking to an audience. And their job, as much as it is to represent you, is to get reelected. So they're going to do things, even if it's the wrong thing, even if it's just a Band-Aid over a situation, sometimes just by doing actions or preventing actions from happening, they are speaking to a constituency that potentially could get them elected again. He identifies four biases that we typically have. First one is, and this is the one I would ask everyone to kind of step back and really think about, because we live in magical times. And I really mean that. Historically speaking, you're freer than you've ever been. You're wealthier than you've ever been. I mean, you individually. I'm talking about the average person. But we underestimate the wisdom of the market. And we underestimate the power of the market to make decisions. So if you ever wanted to know why something has risen to the top, there may have been a number of things that restricted competition. But those areas that are freer, well, the market's pretty good. I'm sorry, the individuals are pretty good at determining who the winners and losers are going to be. And one of the other things is that we have a huge distrust of foreigners. And you're saying, well, no, we don't. No, I don't. Well, if you hear some of the rhetoric, like, I would never buy this type of service from this group or that group, that's one of the areas that we see it in immigration and the distrust of people coming in and things of that nature. Well, there's another area which you could, you know, lift your mind, lift the worry. We're pretty good at finding good people to work with, mm-hmm. or better people to work with. And then we undervalue the benefits of conserving labor. And what that really means is you've got computers, you've got time-saving machines, you've got all sorts of things that are available to you. And many times people are focused on, like, well, if I ordered my fast food from a screen, it's putting a cashier out of business. Or I go to the grocery store and I go through the self-serve line to check out, I'm putting a cashier out of a job. And so those time-saving and things are basically someone sitting down and kind of thinking things out. We usually find ways to get those people other jobs. Mm-hmm. And while any particular area could be devastated, imagine you're in an area and you've got one plant or one thing you're offering, and that market goes away. Well, that happened in my area. We had textiles all around us, and those went away where I grew up. But we found other industries, other things that we could work on. Mm-hmm. So just recognizing that the time you live on right now, even as wonderful or as bad as it is at any particular time, time marches on and opportunities also reveal themselves. And here's one of the other last thoughts that he has, is that many people are very pessimistic. They think, like, there was some heyday in the past that was so much better than today. And while certainly COVID is a challenge that we're dealing with, and any other things in the past you could think of that are negative or things that you could think about, you know, what we've proved, at least over the last 250 years, if not over since the beginning of humankind, is that things do get better. We certainly, the idea that things were really, really good at some point in the past and they're only going to get worse, well, that many times is just in your mind. And you need to be a little more optimistic about where this could come. All right, so I'm going to end with the idea that one of the areas that we all could improve upon is recognizing that there's wisdom in crowds, that, you know, you making your individual decision is wonderful, but you're biased. But the crowd, us as each of us making those individual decisions, the crowd will let the cream rise, and that stop demanding as much from our leaders, and recognizing that the market is an incredibly powerful way to have basically the winners reveal themselves and work for our benefit. So, yeah, there are always opportunities to show a bad player, but bad players you don't have to deal with. You can just choose other things.
Interesting. That is very different from the rhetoric that we hear nowadays over bad decisions and bad players. And trying to be rational and a voter is very difficult because there's a huge emotion involved with that.
Well, there comes with education. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the book that we read earlier this year by the medical doctor who talked about our biases and talked about our expertise. And he said his findings were that even the experts were choosing bad policy. Hmm. And people who are the best of the best, and that's their expertise. And a lot of his findings were that your time of education, or when you receive that education, should be a huge detriment to you changing your mind or having evolution of how you view concepts. These are things I deal with all the time. I ask myself, you know, is this real or am I looking at something through some past knowledge that may not be the most current? Mm. Most of the times I'm usually dealing with rules of the game, but, you know, I'm dealing with some things right now professionally that we just don't know. We're looking at data sets that are from the past, which may or may not reflect what the future will hold. Mm-hmm. And we're being asked to make decisions that people's lives are going to be impacted on those.
Yeah.
Now, I'm usually not dealing with life and death situations, but they're real. Mm-hmm. And
that's certainly what I'm doing in education as well, is we have some big problems in front of us that are life and death, and we have to decide. And our biases certainly have an... different.
Did you say they were life and death?
Yeah, this pandemic and going to school certainly life and death question for sure. And
okay, maybe, sure.
And our biases certainly have a piece of that thinking.
Yeah, this is an incredibly well thought out book. You may not come to the same conclusion as Brian Kaplan, but there's no doubt that if you spend some time working through his material, that you will certainly become a deeper thinker, and you certainly will become a more open thinker to allowing other people to make the choices that they feel are to their benefit. Mm-hmm. And that's probably where I enjoy his writing most. I recommend this book. Once again, it may not be for everyone, but if the subject interests you, take a ride.
There you go. That is The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies by Brian Kaplan.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our Scroll with It.
Steve, baseball is back. Yes. Tell me something fun.
I have paid money to watch baseball on TV, and I tell you what, baseball on TV has certainly changed. Since there's no audience in the stadium watching the baseball game with us, they have added the sounds from the video game to the pictures on TV so that we get some semblance of normality.
All right, so I'm going to back up real quick. It's not in our notes, but the NBA commissioner has, they're considering delaying the games. As a not hard, you know, long-term delay, but having a 3, 5, 7 second delay to you receiving it.
Yes.
Because there's nobody in the audience.
Yes.
And the people are talking on the court, and they're not always saying the best words.
There have been some issues in baseball already where the two teams were yelling at each other across the dugouts, and the umpires in the middle had to stop them from doing that because they could be heard across the country. Yes, we live in different times, my friend.
All right, Steve. They may be yelling their favorite stuff, but is anyone else yelling anything in the stands?
Popcorn! Peanuts! Can't tell the players without a program! Program's here! Tom Hanks, the Tom Hanks, the nicest man in Hollywood, has lent his voice as a vendor for Oakland A's games.
So one of his first jobs when he was a young man was he worked at the Oakland A's, and that's exactly what he was doing. He was slinging out peanuts, and so he decided that this was one of the things that he could offer the A's. How lovely is that?
That's amazing. I hope that this is going to become a trend and we're going to hear Bill Murray at the Cubs games and the famous Sox fan at the Sox games.
That's right. The unnamed Sox fan. That's the unknown comment. That'll be who it is.
just get Ronnie Woo Woo to do a little recording for the Cubs. I think we'd be all right.
All right. Well, so... Irregardless is a perfectly prominent word, Steve. It embiggens our vocabulary.
My English major heart is breaking with this story, Chip. Yes. Irregardless is a word in the Merriam-Webster dictionary. God bless our souls.
Well, I was going to say, who owns the language, Steve? Who owns the language? The people own the language.
Yes.
From 1795, they've been using this word, Steve.
Okay, fine. Put it in the dictionary. I will just be the old curmudgeon who has to have the argument with people that, yes, fine, it's fine. I make the argument all the time. Language has to change. If language does not change, it dies. That's what happened to Latin.
All right, so Steve, let's just go, and as we learn that irregardless is now a word... Let's look at the history of cromulent and embiggens.
Those are perfectly cromulent words. I don't know what you're talking about.
So, how do we know those words, Steve?
Those are from The Simpsons. Those are the words that were used to show the ignorance of Springfield in The Simpsons, and we, the community of Simpsons fans, have adopted those words as real words in our daily language. I hear the word cromulent on podcasts every week.
All right, so this was written into, was it Jebediah Springfield? Mm-hmm. That was his quote. He was quoted using those words.
Yes.
And Lisa questioned it. But the writers are the most fun, who wrote this series. They were told that they needed to create two words that looked and sounded like they were real words. So cromulent means acceptable or fine, right?
Yeah, that's what it means. It's perfectly cromulent. It's almost always with the modifier perfectly. It's all that was the direct quote from the episode. Perfectly cromulent.
And of course, the word embiggens. Yeah.
Yes, go on.
Well, it means to make bigger.
That's right. That's what embiggens means. It's right there in the word. I don't know what your problem is with these two words. We use these words all the time. These are perfectly cromulent words.
So the beauty of our language is not only do Americans get to pronounce all sorts of foreign words with English pronunciations, as we've learned from this podcast, I can mispronounce many, many words. That's right.
Doe was actually added to the Merriam-Webster dictionary as well. So The Simpsons is a huge influencer on my daily language. And yes, fine, you can have irregardless, fine. But you have to say it with a Boston accent. You have to say irregardless.
Irregardless. In fact, that will be the pronunciation that will be in the dictionary right there. We'll just go ahead and add that.
Irregardless.
Irregardless with Harvard. Park the car. go Red Sox, right?
Or
the Sox.
Or the baseball team in Connecticut.
Ah. Is there one?
I don't think so.
No.
We'll
just name one.
We'll have to find our expert from Connecticut to ask her about baseball, huh?
Well, she can join us, or in fact, our listeners can join us for sandwiches at irregular hours, Steve.
Yes, we are finishing up the entire canon of Sherlock Holmes mysteries in the next few days, and we've had so much fun discussing them every morning with Professor Pamela Bedore, and boy, we are... anticipating being done with that project and finding something else to talk with Professor Bedore about.
Sure, we've got something in the works. We'll announce it at a future time. But we want to mention that The Valley of Fear, which is the last novel, finishes up our entire canon of this. It certainly has embiggened my vocabulary, and this has been a perfectly cromulent exploration of Sherlock Holmes.
I'm so happy. You have made me so happy today, Chip.
Irregardless of what you think.
Oh, you ruined it. Join us every morning as we discuss the last few chapters of this book and go back to all of the other episodes and look through all of that wonderful writing from Arthur Conan Doyle. Go to our website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, for all of those conversations all in one place. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week, irregardless of what you think.
Only if we can come back next week.
You ruined the whole thing. See, irregardless ruins things.
Regardless of what you think, Steve.
Perfectly cromulent. If you need more information, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
See you in the future.
Popcorn, peanuts,
irregardless.